Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When former U.S. Poet Laureate Ted Kooser's mother was dying, he wanted to show her how much he had loved the life they had shared. So he did what a poet does. He wrote from his Nebraska perch on a life growing up in Iowa. The fields, people, family, pinochle games. It's an evocation and a kind of love letter to the center of the country and his family's place in it. He's encouraging us all to write our own American family histories. This hour on Point, Ted Kooser, poet, evokes a place and the past. Joining me now from Lincoln, Nebraska, is poet Ted Kooser. He grew up in Iowa, spent 30 years working in the insurance business in Nebraska, writing every morning, published his first book of poems in 1969, won the Pulitzer Prize for his 2004 volume, Delights and Shadows. In that same year, he was named Poet Laureate of the United States. He's a professor of English at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. His new book, A Love Letter to the Country's Heartland and His Family Roots, is called Lights on a Ground of Darkness, an Evocation of a Place and Time. Ted Kooser, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. What a wonderful, I called it a big little book because it is small, just 60 pages, but it is so resonant with the family personalities and place and history that you pack into it. You generously quote Edwin Muir and take your title from him, the Scottish poet, at the beginning here. I don't know if you've got the book there, Ted, but I wonder if you just read what Edwin Muir, before we get to your great work, what he said about time and words and imagination and holding the past.
Well, if I can find that page.
Right there after your acknowledgments.
Oh, yes, right. Yep. I've got it. Mm-hmm. Time wakens a longing more poignant than all the longings caused by the division of lovers in space, for there is no road back into its country. Our bodies were not made for that journey. Only the imagination can venture upon it. And the setting out, the road, and the arrival, all is imagination. Our memories of a place, no matter how fond we were of it, are little more than a confusion of lights on a ground of darkness.
Confusion of lights on a ground of darkness, and there you take your title. And I was moved by your description of the last days of your mother that encouraged you to do this, Ted. It was a decade or more ago now. But what was it you set out to do for her, for yourself in the doing, for your family with this work?
Well, I wanted to keep them all alive a little longer somehow, and you can do that in writing, I think. We can talk more about that as we go here, but Mother had chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and a bad heart and was in an assisted living center, and it was clear that she was ready to go and would die soon. And I thought, you know, I've been putting off this book for years and years because, and I guess this is true of a lot of writers, I was afraid I'd screw it up. I was afraid that I'd mess up the material somehow or other and spoil it. So,
and it was too important. It was too central to you, maybe.
It was the important thing, I think. It was what I would, I guess what we would say was my best material, you know, that family. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't want to mess it up. And so I finally began to gather all these loose pieces together that I'd written and then write some more and kind of put it together. And I was scared to death to show it to Mom because I was afraid she'd feel terribly sad, you know, at the end of her life. All these people were dead to read it. But it didn't happen that way at all. She really liked it.
She had a chance to read some of it. You open the book with a poem to her. We'll come to your prose on past and time and place and people, but this is such a beautiful poem to your mother, Vera Dolores Moser Kooser. I wish you'd read it for us.
Sure. I wrote this on the occasion of my birthday, which followed my mother's death by just a month. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I would write a letter to her to tell her what had happened since she died. Mid-April already, and the wild plums bloom at the roadside. a lacy white against the exuberant, jubilant green of new grass and the dusty, fading black of burnt-out ditches. No leaves, not yet, only the delicate star-petaled blossoms, sweet with their timeless perfume. You have been gone a month today and have missed three rains and one night-long watch for tornadoes. I sat in the cellar from 6 to 8 while fat spring clouds went somersaulting, rumbling east. Then it poured, a storm that walked on legs of lightning, dragging its shaggy belly over the fields. The meadowlarks are back and the finches are turning from green to gold. Those same two geese have come to the pond again this year, honking in over the trees and splashing down. They never nest, but stay a week or two, then leave. The peonies are up, the red sprouts burning in circles like birthday candles, for this is the month of my birth, as you know, the best month to be born in, thanks to you, everything ready to burst with living. There will be no more new flannel nightshirts sewn on your old black singer, no birthday card addressed in a shaky but businesslike hand. You ask me if I would be sad when it happened, and I am sad. But the iris I moved from your house now hold in the dusty, dry fists of their roots green knives and forks, as if waiting for dinner, as if spring were a feast. I thank you for that. Were it not for the way you taught me to look at the world, to see the life at play in everything, I would have to be lonely forever.
Former U.S. Poet Laureate Ted Kooser reading the opening poem from his new book, Lights on a Ground of Darkness, dedicated to the memory of his mother, Vera Dolores Moser Kooser. I have to say that that put more than a lump in my throat, Ted. That's just a...
Well, thank you, Tom. Thank
beautiful,
you.
Beautiful poem. You know, I lost my own very beloved mother this summer in the Midwest, and I spent the last 4 days at her side. They were incredibly precious.
Oh, yeah.
Beyond description, I thought. But then I read your book and I think, you know, maybe it's not. Maybe those most intimate, the most intimate experiences, exchanges are not beyond description for a poet, for you.
Well, I don't know that it really takes a poet. You know, it really just takes honesty, I think. Being willing to write those things down. And I tell students all the time that, or you know, beginning writers that I, you know, I mm-hmm. see at workshops and so on, that mm-hmm. that if they simply write a few pages in handwriting and put them in a manila folder and stick them in a drawer somewhere, that with no pretensions of ever wanting to publish a book or anything, that someday somebody will come along and find that folder and open it up, and that person who's described in those pages will lift up into the light a little bit again. And it's a wonderful thing, really.
It's true. A kind of immortality there. I've seen it in old 19th century diaries from my own family where they're waving pine knots in the night on the way home from quilting bees to keep the wolves away.
Oh, my,
away.
Yeah.
And just telling it as if it were, you know, an everyday story, or, you know, driven hogs on horseback to Chicago, coming back and falling through the Kickapoo Creek and being frozen in the saddle when they got home, and, you know, needing to be thawed out by the fire like a wishbone. I
mean, write just, those down, Tom.
They're written down, and I turn those pages. But you know, to your mother, were it not for the way you taught me to look at the world, to see the life at play in everything, I would have to be lonely forever. That's a poet laureate writing, Ted Kooser.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Tell us about your family's roots, as you have it, in Iowa. Swiss immigrants who came, down the Ohio, up the Mississippi, and settled where?
You know, I assume down the Ohio and up the Mississippi to the Bluff Country at the northeast corner of Iowa, Clayton County, Iowa. Grandma's family, their name was Morand, and they were, we believe, Austrians, and grandfather's family were Swiss Germans. Mm-hmm. And they settled in this area up there, which is very poor farm ground, you know, little tiny pastures in between these big bluffs and so on. And And
Guttenberg and the Turkey
Guttenberg,
River?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Guttenberg, Iowa, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, on the where the Turkey River runs down and empties into the Mississippi in this county, and so they were in that area, yeah.
Like many early settlers, they didn't take the best land. It wasn't tiled and drained yet. It was hard to figure out what to do
maybe.
And the older, hilly, stony, forested stuff was more like home.
That's exactly right, and that's true here in Nebraska, too. I've talked to old Czech farmers here as to, you know, why they seemed to pick the worst land, and they would say, well, it reminded us of city or places in Czechoslovakia or in Bohemia.
Yeah, I've got the same kind of farmland in the family from settling in 1818, and it was the ones who came later who had the big, sort of broad, beautiful, Iowa or Illinois classic field. But your family didn't stay on the farm. There was a fire. After 40 years, your grandfather moved into town and ran a Standard Oil gas station back when those came with uniforms and crisp hats.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, there was just the one boy in the family who could have taken over the farm, and that was my Uncle Elvie, who had cerebral palsy, and as a result of his illness, just could not do that. So once the farm burned down, it was a terrible discouragement, and my grandfather sold the farm to his sister-in-law and then moved to town and built a house and a gas station right next to it. And we spent a lot of time out at the old place over the years, you know, going back out there because we had, you know, there was the whole area was family.
Susan in Chesapeake, Virginia, you're on the air with Ted Kooser in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Well, thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
And
hi,
hello,
Susan.
Mr. Kooser.
Hi there.
I have to say that my eyes were swimming when you were reading your poem, the beginning of your book. My mother passed away in 1971, and it's still very recent for me, and there was alcohol involved in the family and kind of fractured the family. And so it wasn't until last year I was able to start putting things down and writing about my family and my life. And
good for you.
Yes.
1971 until last year. But I mean, you waited half a life.
Was yes.
It was too
yes.
hard or too painful or really
too
all
painful.
That time?
Too painful. Mm-hmm. And it's as if she passed away yesterday. It's so far away, but yet it is so real, as if it was yesterday.
Ted Kooser, you're a practiced writer. It didn't take you half a century to turn to writing these memories, but you can hear, for someone like Susan, it was daunting, and daunting for a long time.
Well, I guess for the same reason I was talking about, I don't mean to put words into Susan's mouth, mm. but when you have material like this, you know, it's frightening to take it on and to present it to the world. And you want to do it perfectly, and you know you won't be able to, and so on. But it needs to be, it really needs to be done. It's very important. I look at the obituary page with those photographs of the mugshots of people who have gone out of the world, and for every one of those faces, a million memories has disappeared. And I keep thinking, we've got to get these memories down so other people can hold them, you know.
Your evocation, and Susan, thank you for your call. We're glad you're writing that down. Your evocation, Ted Kooser, is by and large a joyful evocation of a time there in the Midwest on a childhood on the banks of the Mississippi and near it. I mean, there's painful parts, too. Your Uncle Elvie, growing up with cerebral palsy, was not always treated well, though he was often and dearly well-treated by the family. What's the balance of pain and joy as you look back? And were you editing for the joy since you were kind of writing for your dying mother?
Well, I suppose perhaps, but I was a very fortunate person in that I had a very happy childhood. There's always been this sort of persistent myth that to be an artist, a successful artist of any kind, you have to have suffered these terrible childhoods and so on. But I have very good friends. I have a landscape painter friend here in Nebraska who is a marvelous painter who had a blissfully happy childhood, and so on. You know, it's you know, and I, of course there was sadness in our family, but I see it as mostly joyful.
Your grandmother and grandfather, 40 years on the home place until they were in their 60s, farming with horses when they began, you know, gardening and canning and preserving pork by frying. And then one, when they were well on, one cold December day in the 1930s, Elvie, with cerebral palsy, was putting Christmas wrapping paper into the stove, and the core of the brick chimney caught fire, and everything changed, Ed.
That's right, yeah, yeah. He was trying to help, and altered the course of everything. That, and of course, at that, in those days, a farmhouse miles from anywhere, if it caught on fire, you just walked off into the field and watched it burn. There was nothing you could do.
If he had been able-bodied, he might have been able to build it back, but that wasn't an option, and into town they went. And the
That's
station.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Let me get a call from Jim in Boquilla, Florida. Jim, you're on the air with Ted Kuser.
Thanks, Tom and Ted. I just wanted to say that I was driving down the road, heard this program, and it struck an unbelievable chord because I grew up in Iowa, grew up in Ames, which I believe Ted was where Ted was went
yes.
to school.
Yes.
And then my parents grew up, or my grandfather and was up in Fayette County, West Union, and they took me with my dad and my grandfather fishing on the Turkey River.
You were right there.
And I understand peonies. Right. I understand peonies and irises in Grandma's yard
yes,
probably more
too.
Than anybody in Florida does.
Yeah. So, Jim, you probably have gone to the cemetery on Memorial Day with a can full of peonies sitting on your lap and sloshing water in your crotch like I do.
You've got and marched around the county courthouse playing the trombone, on Memorial Day.
Right.
Done all the things, and my folks lived all over the country and finally went back to Ames towards the end of their life. And that's where they said that was the best place for them to be and, after going, north, south, east, and west.
And, Jim, what's it mean to you to have a poet laureate for a couple of big years from that part of the country?
Well, when I got we get a quarterly newsletter from the high school, and there was a big article about Ted as the distinguished alumni of our high school. And I thought, well, that's pretty good. No, I think Ted was about 10 years ahead of me in school, if I recall right, in the mid-60s. Was that right?
Class of 57.
There you go.
57. All right, well, then you were only 3 years ahead of me.
and the Turkey River fully in mind there. Jim, thank you very much for making that connection. Thanks for calling, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And that mason jar with the peonies, I remember even, of course, having those in the Midwest. They're so beautiful at Memorial Day time. And even picnicking in the very old cemeteries around the graves with the peonies all around. Irises, we already heard in your opening poem, and I hope we hear more on irises there. Ted, Jim, we're so happy to hear from you. Let me get one more here from Reading, Massachusetts. Linda. Linda, you're on the air.
Good. How are you doing today?
We're great. What do you know?
Well, I just wanted to mention how evocative scents and tastes can be. I whenever I taste a warm raspberry, I'm in the garden with my grandfather, watching the sweat go down his brow as he's taking care of the canes. Or sometimes when I smell baking, I'm with my grandmother in the kitchen, and poetry can do the same. Just in general, when literature pulls that same deep memory out of you, it's just so wonderful. And I really thank you for putting your deep memories down.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
A sun-warmed raspberry memory there and a grandfather's sweat. Thank you, Linda. You know, Ted Kuser, it makes me want to hear something from your book. You've got a business, a bit here that takes us to your grandfather and his work in the gas station after he had left the farm, years of work there. If you could read a little bit, I think you can bring us, you can evoke some of that right here in response to Linda's offering there.
Yes, all right. My grandfather's always to smell of warm motor oil and hot rubber tires and Prince Albert tobacco. He has the kind of strong, warm hands that a child can never forget, the kind that seem to hold sun in their skin and that know exactly what to do in any tearful emergency, how to fix a cap pistol when the hammer has fallen out with a heartbreaking clink, or how to pull a fishhook out of the ball of your thumb. His standard station is full service at a time when nobody has experienced service that is anything other than full. In mid-February, with a 20-below-zero blizzard howling down the river, he'll wrap a scarf around his head, raise your old Chevy on the outdoor pneumatic hoist, take off a flat tire, patch it, and put it back on, all for a quarter. The purchase of a gallon of gas will get your tires and oil checked and your windows washed. He'll change your oil for the price of the oil. The station is a gathering place for men who have nothing better to do than to sit in the shade and swap stories. Like my grandfather, these men are mostly old farmers retired from their fields. There's a pop case in which bottles of soda, knee-high grape, oh-so-orange, strawberry, cream soda, are submerged to their caps in water, cooled by a block of ice. Between the station and the highway is an island of grass, and my grandfather has set up a horseshoe court there. Sometimes the men pitch horseshoes, their faces dark with concentration. Mostly they sit and talk, and I want desperately to be a part of their company, to tell my own good stories. But it is impossible for a little boy to get a word in edgewise. So, with my Uncle Elvie, who can't be understood when he talks, I listen. Though I don't know it yet, I will one day be a writer, and my poems and stories will be my way of applying for acceptance into that same circle of old men, though they will all be ghosts by the time I am ready to tell them a story.
Former U.S. Poet Laureate Ted Kooser reading from his new evocation, Lights on a Ground of Darkness. I wondered about that, Ted, what you wanted to show your mother with these passages. Did you want to show her that the time would be remembered? Did you want her to feel honored by the obvious love in what you wrote? All that? Something else?
I think the latter, probably. I wanted her to enjoy it. I wanted her to be sort of with me in those memories. At the end of her life, but also to show her that I honored the childhood I'd had.
And a grandfather with the kind of strong, warm hands that a child can never forget. Let's take a call from Louisville, Kentucky. Joe, you're on the air with Ted Kooser.
Yes, hi, gentlemen. Thank you for taking
the call.
Hey, one of the things that, I write a little bit poetry, mostly I deal with writing music and songwriting in acoustic, mostly. And the idea, I just want to convey, the idea is kind of the same way in that my dad was a songwriter, song player, mostly, performed. And I'd watch him for hours just while he was up on the stage and that sort of thing. And just that that legacy that I've tried to do with the music, but also at the same time trying to remember him in some of my songs. And although it may not relate directly, like using the essence is there mostly. That's really what I'm trying to say.
Sure, with the music capturing the same way poetry or this kind of evocation memoir might, Joe.
Right. And even though I don't talk about him necessarily, you know, that personal in the music, I may have a feeling about what's going on and bring that out in a particular song or whatever. So I think I agree, it's essentially a legacy that he may not even be aware of most of the time, although I do share some of that stuff with him and do play with him at times.
Joe, that's great.
It's really good. Well, anyway, I just wanted to present that.
Appreciate that. Yeah. Ted, music is right in the your pages as well. In prose.
Well, you know, I wanted to say that one of the great highlights of my 2 years as Poet Laureate was bringing John Prine to the Library of Congress to sit on the stage and talk about writing songs as a writer. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time that a folk singer had been on that stage since Woody Guthrie in 1936. It was quite a moment.
I can't get enough of your reading here. You've got a passage where music plays a central role. You're visiting relatives as a child. Clarence and Parthenia stopping by. Could you set it up and read a bit for us?
Yeah, we're, I,
page
we all,
43, everyone, there's a...
Right, sorry. Yeah. Everyone in the family wonders where Parthenia got her name. My Aunt Annie must have been reading some pretty high-powered novels
I guess,
something at
yeah,
the time.
Yeah.
Okay, such music there is in the past. Clarence and Parthenia Meyer are also stopping by for coffee later. Parthenia is one of my mother's favorite cousins and the only daughter of my great-aunt Annie and Uncle Fred Mosier. The two girls grew up on adjacent farms and often played together as little girls. Parthenia is a big woman, a Mosier through and through, with a broad smile of fine teeth and a wen on the side of her nose. Years from now, when Parthenia is in her 70s, she will tell me about her late husband's polka band, the Jolly Ridge Hillbillies. She said she bought his first accordion for him as a gift when they were sparking back in 1931. The accordion was an L Italia model and had a bright red bellows covered with white polka dots. One day, as a surprise for her, he brought the accordion to the country school where she was teaching and played it for her pupils. One little boy went home that evening and told his parents, "Teacher's fella came to school and played music for us on a thing all fastened together with red neckties." Clarence married Parthenia and went on to play music all his life. He farmed for a living, and in the evenings, after the hard work of the long day had been set aside, he and his three sons, each of whom he taught to play various instruments, filled their big frame house with music. I remember it from my childhood as being like a huge box of light and laughter and music. At Saturday night dances, Clarence and his friends, squeezing out waltzes and polkas and schottisches, kept generations of my plump German cousins gasping for breath and sweating through the backs of their best dresses and overalls.
Ted Kooser from Light on a Ground of Darkness. It is so poignant. It brings it so to mind, and it's wonderful. And at the same time, Ted, I'm guessing that scene is gone. And there's pain in that, in knowing that. You bring it to mind so beautifully that, in a way, the pain's more exquisite of the fact that a certain kind of life is past, just past.
Oh, yeah. I go up to that farm where the Myers lived, and it's still in the family. A grandson has it now, and you know, but it you can't quite people it again in the same way and fill it out in the same way and everything. By the way, Clarence, after he died, Parthenia had a quarter note carved in his headstone. Wow. I think it's a wonderful touch.
Right. A gesture to it, but the thing itself gone. I've been struggling with that. When you lose loved ones, as you say, their memories go with them. And it seems that a whole time can slip away, almost impossible to get your hand on again.
That's right, yeah.
Except for in the imagination, as you remind us right from the top of your beautiful book. Ted Kooser's in Lincoln, Nebraska today. Sandra's calling from Litchfield, Connecticut. Sandra, you're on the air.
Yes, I am. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks.
Hi.
This is very poignant for me as well. I am a nurse and a poet, and my mom was 92 years old when she came home from the hospital with congestive heart failure and COPD. I took a leave of absence and brought her home to my house, and it was an amazing experience, and she was on oxygen and in a wheelchair, and one day I was putting some pills in pudding, and I heard my name, Sandra, and I said, "Yes, Mommy," and she wheeled herself over to me and made this inch sign with her forefinger and thumb and had looked up at me, and I said, "Single malt scotch?" She's the love of single malt scotch. And she nodded, and I said, "Sure, I'll join you." So we toasted each other. It was absolutely, she died about 2.5 weeks later. It was not the single malt scotch that had anything to do with it. It was an amazing experience. And then I remember I had written a poem, a nature poem, quote, unquote, about the time she had lost her first baby up in the North Maine woods in a log cabin because she had no one to help her, and her younger sister panicked and fled, and the baby bled to death and died at the side of her body. And I had never shown her this poem, but I decided to take the risk, and I showed it to her when she was with me, and I watched her read it, and there was a stillness in the air you could palpate. And then she started sobbing, "My baby, my baby, oh, this is beautiful, this is beautiful." And we hugged each other, and I think it was the first time she was able to grieve over the loss of that baby. It was absolutely, it was just an amazing experience. And we had
a wonderful
other
story.
Sandra,
I held
you.
Her hand when she died, and she was beautiful. And I miss her.
Sandra, thank you. Ted, there's a poet speaks there of her own passage with her mother.
Yeah, what a story. It's wonderful.
It's a time when that sharing becomes so important. I'm not sure everyone has that feeling of making the connection while it's possible. But you say write it down even if that beloved one is gone.
I think so. You know, the other night a man was telling me that he was trying to make amends to a lot of people in his family that he'd hurt over the years, and he said that he was writing letters to them. Some of them had been dead for 10 or 15 years, and he said, "I go out and sit in my car and listen to the radio and write letters to them." And I thought, it's marvelous, you know, what that's going to do for him.
And reading you here, it is anything but sad necessarily or morbid in any way. There's a passage I just loved here where you're writing in the first person, you're putting yourself back in time. You write, "As I glance up from the sidewalk, a young woman throws up a ratty window sash and leans out, licking her lips in the delicious candy of cold air. She's wearing a crisp-looking white blouse and has a red scarf tied at her neck. She makes a lovely flag with far more life to her than sour Old Glory sternly snapping its fingers high above." Wow, that's anything but morose. It's wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Just wonderful. Let's go to Yuta in Marblehead, Massachusetts. Yuta, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Kuzer.
Hi.
I am so blessed to have been at home to listen to this program. I was very deeply moved the minute you talked about the title of your book, A Love Letter to the Heartland. I immediately remembered how my life in America began in the Midwest. I was very young then. I was 23 years old. I married an American. This is why I came here from Germany. And now I am old. I'm 72. We lived 20 years in the Midwest. And to this day, we raised our children there, and my fondest memories are with the center of this beautiful land, America. Then you read your wonderful, deeply moving letter to a poem about your mother. Mm. It brought tears to my eyes immediately. Who came to mind? My own mother, my grandmother. And all my childhood memories of Germany just seemed to rise to the surface during the last half hour. I had to call you. I look so forward to reading your book. And one of my favorite quotes in life, I want to share, it says, "Our memories cradle our grief and preserve all our joy."
Wonderful.
Thank you, Yuta.
Yeah, thank
all
you.
My life I have been wondering about two issues. Is it better to live with your family for generations in one region, like you have such so beautiful, it seems, to have written about your own family? My journey went so differently. I moved around a great deal. Not always was it my own choice. And I have always wondered which type of living is richer and better. I do want to believe, because I left Europe and my painful memories of my childhood years with the Second World War and our German history, I believe I have become a totally different person thanks to having been living in America.
Yehuda, you put so much there. Let us go to it. This is a great question. I mean, it's an immigrant's question. The value of generations with the family. What if you break that? Those generations. Really, an American question too, Ted Kooser. I mean, you made your own migration just 400 miles or so. But I wonder how you think about that.
Well, but we're carrying all those places or those few places, we're carrying them about with us all the time. They shape everything we do, you know. It's I don't know about the richness of it. I suppose in a way we could talk about the excitement of it or the stress of it or so on, of moving around a great deal or, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of thing. It's a very complicated question, I think, and a very interesting one. I have no idea what it would be like to go to the other side of the world. I mean, I don't think I could have ever done it. I am so deeply rooted, you know, where I am.
But you did go from Ames to Lincoln. I mean, it's not exactly a micro move. What about that? I mean, are you 30 years working in the insurance company, writing at the crack of dawn your poetry? But did you feel in some ways a migrant too, even though you're sort of on just different corners of the Great Plains?
Well, I'll tell you what, as a young man, I got just far enough away from home that I could get away with things that I couldn't get away with at home, I suppose, you know. But, it's about a four-hour car drive, just that's all. But I came to Nebraska to go to graduate school, and it happened that I liked Nebraska, and I just stayed. But I was always going back home. I'd like to be there right now. The fall in that part of Iowa is gorgeous.
Oh, yeah. When you became poet laureate in 2004, Edward Hirsch wrote in the Washington Post, and he talking about other Nebraska poets, Willa Cather and John Nehart and Weldon Keyes and Lauren Isley, and he says the Great Plains seemed to foster a plain homemade style, a sturdy forthrightness with hidden depths, hard-won clarity chastened by experience, unadorned, pragmatic, quintessentially American poetry of empty places. Of farmland. And he said the poets from Nebraska have a reticent manner and a determinedly accessible style, a sensitivity to the natural world that at times reminds me, that is Edward Hirsch, of Chinese poets, and owes a great debt to the Native American sensibility. What do you make of the characterization, Ted Kooser?
Well, you know, that's very interesting. I have a poem in the current issue of the Atlantic Monthly, The Atlantic, that just came out, and it's a poem about old men, and I'm among them, sitting in the sun. And when David Barber, the poetry editor, took that poem, he wrote me back and he said, it reminds me of the Tang poets. Mm. So there is something there, I suppose. I'm not smart enough to pick that kind of thing up myself, but, you know, I have read a great deal of Asian poetry over the years, and I love it. I love it because it is rich with setting, and I, as much as anything else, almost all those ancient, those old poems that have lasted forever and ever have setting very, place is very important in them, yeah.
A little Tang Dynasty in Lincoln, Nebraska. Kelsey in Greenville, Ohio, you're on the air with Ted Kooser.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ted.
Hello.
Hi.
I had the pleasure of hearing Ted speak at a writer's conference in Columbus, Ohio. And afterwards, when everyone else went off to their sessions, I sat down and talked with Ted. I don't know if you would remember, that was a couple years ago. And wasn't that big into poetry at the time and never, you know, thought about writing anything along that line. And then after talking with Ted and after hearing some of his poetry, I remember driving home from Columbus, Ohio to Greenville, it's like a two-hour drive, and seeing fields of lightning bugs. And it reminded me of how, when I was a little kid, chasing around lightning bugs with ball jars and, you know, lighting off fireworks and having run around the yard with sparklers. And I took just my inspiration from Ted and from these lightning bugs, and I wrote an article, and I submitted it to the Christian Science Monitor. It was published, and I just wanted to call and thank Ted for inspiring people to look back at their memories and to put it down. And so, you know, my daughter someday will read that article and read about her dad chasing down lightning bugs. So thank you very
well,
much.
Well, congratulations. The Monitor it had that tradition of publishing personal essays or familiar essays like that I always loved about that newspaper. I'm sorry that newspaper is gone.
Kelsey, thank you so much for calling. We'll picture the lightning bugs. Ted, I want to try and get one more reading from you if we can. It's so mm-hmm. good to have. You go back to 1949 and a memory of being your grandparent, a little boy is there in your grandparents' place, your father gathering an arm of tiger lilies, irises kind of shriveled, and then you write an April morning nearly 50 years later. Could you pick it up for us?
An April morning, nearly 50 years later. My mother has recently died at age 89, my last living link to the stories of her family. She has left me to reckon with a rapidly fading past that will, from the day of her death forward, be, as Edwin Muir described it, little more than a confusion of lights on a ground of darkness. This is the rainy season when the Turkey River bears close watching. In Osterdock, an old man in a cap with ear flaps leans over the bridge rail to observe the water inching up the supporting columns. He has a red face and a drop of clear moisture at the end of his nose. It's a new bridge, made of concrete, wide and solid. The former bridge was narrow, riveted together out of steel, and it shuddered ominously whenever a floating tree trunk bumped a support. Nearby is the broken and overgrown foundation of the general merchandise store where we once bought ice cream cones, where my grandmother and her sister Laura waited outside in the shade of a tree. The old man tells me he cannot remember my mother, Vera Mosier, or her brother, Elvie, or her parents, John and Liz, but he says with a smile that the hills along the Turkey River are full of Mosiers and Morans. 400 miles from this new bridge that reaches not merely over a flooded river, but pushes forward out of the past, the irises in my garden will soon bloom. Their petals are tightly furled, spun into tight little cones of rich color, yellow and blue. Within a day or two, they will be open, lush and loose, spilling their fragrance. Old irises from these green hills, their gnarled roots borne from house to house, from garden to garden, down through time. An iris is forever young because it has no stories to sadden it, to weigh it down. Before me I see the violet ones, the blue ones, the yellow, the brown, and the silky white ones marked with blue, the salmon-colored ones, the coral and pink. They began their journey long before I was born, and 100 years ago my grandmother's mother, Dorothea Morand, seated on her front stoop just a mile from where the old man and I looked down upon the river, waited for them with the same anticipation that I feel today. And yet the irises are oblivious of me and my family, are indifferent as the whitewashed boulders along that long-ago driveway, stones that turned their backs to my Uncle Elvie as he dragged his sack of fish into the yard at twilight. An iris offers its beauty and fragrance as if nothing had changed, as if no one were gone.
Ted Kuza, reading from Lights on the Ground of Darkness. Those irises are still in your backyard if I read this book.
Correct. They are indeed. They are indeed.
And Uncle Elvie, I want to give him just another moment's attention before our time with you comes to an end. It was not an easy life. At the end, he was, I guess, hospitalized, and your grandfather slept next to him in a nursing home, I guess, for a couple of years to keep him company.
That's
but he's
right.
he's in a way the hero of your memory, your book, next to your mother.
He is at the center of the family's love. I think that this is possible, not in every family, but if you have an impaired, badly impaired person in the family and the family gathers around that person, they become the glue that holds the family together in a way. It's an unfortunate metaphor, I guess, but they become the armature about which the family winds, let's say.
Winds and... And Uncle Elvie, that for your family. Elvie as in Elva, named after Alva in the Bible, and somehow here comes the E.
Yeah, who knows where that came from, how they corrupted that spelling over the years, yeah.
Well, it's a very beautiful book and a very beautiful evocation. Your mother is lucky to have such a son, a poet laureate, who could bring the riverbanks of Iowa and all that family history and love back so beautifully. Thank you, Ted Kuza, for this work and for your time.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a real pleasure, and I'd like to hear about your background someday. So when you write it down, let me know.
Okay. We'll open some cider on a nice autumn afternoon.
All right.
Great. Ted Kooser, joining us from Lincoln, Nebraska, former poet laureate of the United States. His new book is Lights on a Ground of Darkness. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Suzanne Merkelson and Patrick Rosso. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.